Hello and welcome to the second in batch two of the Falklands War podcast. Tonight, today, whenever you're listening to this, we are joined by Commander Nigel Ward, unknown as Sharky or Mr. Sea Harrier. He is nothing if not irrepressible. He is an amazing character who has had a lot of experience. He says what he thinks, and he doesn't mince his words, which has meant when he's right, he's very right. When he's wrong, he's often in trouble. This is a great interview. This is an interview with Sharky at his full force, where he gives a lot of himself for us to listen to, and a lot for us to learn. I hope all the listeners will find this interview useful. I certainly did. It was an amazing experience to talk it over with Sharky, exactly all he went through, and to understand more about him and his decision-making process. So, without further ado, and without taking up too much of your time, please, enjoy the podcast. I know it's a long one, it's going to be about an hour and 40 minutes, but it's worth it. Take care.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
The first question I start off with, Sharky, is what went through your mind when you heard you were going to war?
I was not surprised because we'd had a squadron commander classified email from First Sea Lord a few weeks earlier saying, make sure your squadron is ready for mobilization if called for. And so when I got the call at 4 o'clock in the morning on the morning of the 1st of April, I was absolutely delighted. I was stuck up in fog in Leicestershire and had to get down to Yeovilton in a hurry with my young son, Christian, who'd been visiting his grandparents. But I got the call, and it was simply from the Duty Lieutenant Commander at Yeovilton saying, from the command, you are to mobilize your squadron for war. And wow, I got shivers down the back like I'm getting now. And I thought, we're going. Fantastic. And the next thing I was doing was in the car, my aging old Volvo estate, going 140 miles down to drop my kid in Wincanton at home and then straight into the squadron by 8:30, when to my eternal joy and surprise, my AEO, Dick Goodenough, and team and all the lads were already in there saying, right, boss, we've got all aircraft serviceable ready to go, but we're getting a couple more from the other squadron. It's going to take us 24 hours to prepare them. When do you want to embark? And that was 8:30 on the Friday morning. So my reaction had been fantastic. And I didn't come down off a high about it, really, until I was on board Invincible, leaving harbour on the Monday morning and having time to think, because in the interim, I got the guys together, got the air warfare instructors together, said, right, we need to do planning straight away because we've done no weaponry trials yet and things like that. So I want that all planned. I want embarkation fully planned. And I want any inputs about what we should be thinking about that I'm not thinking about. So it's going to be a hard working weekend in which you're going to spend your time with your families overnight, but in the squadron by day, and I shall persuade the command or the ship to not embark us until the last minute on Sunday, because the squadron at Yeovilton was governed by Yeovilton, and the captain there was saying, basically, you better get ready to embark on Saturday morning, Sharky. I said, well, hang on, sir. Let me talk to the ship. So I rang up the ship and got in touch with Wings and said, hey, look, no point in us coming on board while you're sort of supplying the ship with stores, storing ship and whatever. And I can do a lot more preparing here at Yeovilton. Can we come on board Sunday afternoon in harbour? And he said, wait one, checked with the captain, and yeah. Captain was delighted to say, yeah, absolutely. I said, well, we'll be there with 8 aircraft and the squadron ground crew, engineers and whatever, will arrive sort of midday Sunday to receive us all. So my response to your question is it was a dream come true that we were actually going to go and fight. Spent 20-odd years in the service practicing for this. It didn't mean you want to go out there and kill anything. It meant now we're going to see whether all our training is worthwhile. And particularly for me, as I was Mr. Sea Harrier and had been given free hand to run the Sea Harrier world to my own pleasure and create all the operational procedures and whatever, it was going to say, yes, you got it right or you didn't. And so for the next couple of weeks as we were sailing south, during the 4 weeks of the journey, I was hoping and praying that Maggie Thatcher wouldn't change her mind. And she didn't, and thank God for that.
Thank you. Second question. You, of course, are Mr. Sea Harrier. Do you want to give a bit of a background to how you got that title? You know, your experience prior to it and building all those documents and basically setting the standard for what would be done with Sea Harrier operations.
Okay, well, I've had a checkered history, as any maverick would have had, because I don't suffer fools gladly, and so I didn't always get on with my superiors. But I'd had a very fascinating prelude to flying the Sea Harrier, which was going to be the first pipeline pilot in the F-4 Phantom 892 squadron, after having been court-martialed for low flying in the Vixen during operational flying training. And then I went, after a year at sea with 892, I went to the Air Warfare Instructor School at Lossiemouth 764 Squadron and qualified there. I was then sent to Norway, of all things, as an intelligence officer, nuclear planning for hitting the Soviets for 2 years before returning to 892 as a senior pilot, as a lieutenant. And the enormity of that was not lost on me, because there were several lieutenant commanders in the squadron, pilots, who I was virtually in command of as a lieutenant, which meant that I had to be tactful as I could, which is not very easy for me. But also I'd learn from them and make the best of it and do my best to run a tight, good squadron. Well, it was a good squadron. We did really well, I think. And I was then sent, after completing that, to, well, I fell out with my boss, by the way, who was in the backseater, called Hugh Drake, who's a nice guy, a very nice guy, but I don't think he appreciated pilots as much as we'd like. And I used to call him, what was the name of that guy with bolts in his neck on the television? Do you remember the...
Yes, I do. Oh, it's one of the things...
And anyway, I used, I used to, excuse the language, piss him off a bit sometimes in the morning by saying, hey, boss, how are your bolts? You know? And so it was not an easy relationship. But I was sent to the naval staff from 892 to take over from a guy called Nick Harris on the Sea Harrier desk. And Nick Harris had done a very good job with the Sea Harrier program. And running the Sea Harrier desk, there was a guy called Mike Layard, who I have the highest respect for now, was my immediate boss as a commander. And he had many other things. He was fixed wing one, did all aspects of fixed wing flying in the Ministry of Defense. And I was his number two, looking after Sea Harrier, every aspect of Sea Harrier, from weapons, the whole lot, training, production, development, whatever. And I was thrown in at the deep end because I hadn't done the staff college, so I knew nothing about Ministry of Defense, really. But I got to know it, and by the time I finished there, I'd achieved one thing early on, which was the worst report in naval staff history, by telling my boss, you know, and not accepting a bollocking from him when I wasn't right. At the end of the time that I was there, we got the Sea Harrier through its development term, and everything was on time and on cost. And it's the first time in military UK history that any jet aircraft project had been on cost and on time at all. And I don't take all the credit for that. I take some of it because Nick Harris before me and the guys before that also were accountable for that. So anyway, a guy called Robin Shercliffe, who became Wings of Hermes during the war, was a friend of mine, and he was my appointer in London. And he called me one day and he said, hey, Sharky, we've got a new appointment for you, if you'd like it. And it's in command of the Flight Trials Unit for Sea Harrier at Yeovilton. I said, wow, yes, I'd like it. Give it me. Yes, please. And he said, good, you're on. And we'll send you your appointment on paper, and good luck. We know you're going to do a good job. So I was thrilled to bloody death, you know. And I looked around and thought about it a bit and said to my immediate superior, who was now Dusty Milner, said, hey, Dusty, where is the DCI, Defence Council instruction, for the new trial squadron, in which instructions are given to the commanding officer as to how he does everything? And Dusty said, wait a minute. He got in touch with Wings, the Commander Air, not Commander Air, not with Wings. He had been Wings, with Neil Rankin, who was Captain Neil Rankin at the time. No, I've got that wrong. Ignore that little bit. Anyway, he said, well, I've researched it, and there isn't a DCI. There is no Defence Council instruction. You'll have to write it. I said, but I'm going to be the new boss, so I'm writing my own instructions, am I, with Ministry of Defence authority? He said, yes. I said, brilliant. So I wrote the instructions for the Flying Trials Unit, and on from there for the headquarters squadron and all the operational trials and procedure stuff to be defined by myself to my own entire satisfaction and to be followed by any of the squadrons forming out of the trials unit and the headquarters squadron, especially frontline squadrons.
Sounds like a dream.
It wasn't a very long DCI. I kept it for quite short. So when I went to Yeovilton and arrived there, I thought, wow, this is a great way to be. Everyone's then had by then been talking about me as Mr. Sea Harrier. He's taking over and whatever. And I got there and there was hardly a welcome at all from the Naval Air Station. They'd got a dirty old hangar for us to use. The offices had nothing in them, no desks, no chairs, no carpets. Clocks had been ripped off the wall and removed in that way. In fact, it was an empty shell of a building. But I had a brilliant new staff officer allocated to me, who used to run in the gun crew, the you know, the tournament, the Royal Tournament, yes. Gun crew. Charlie Sterling, he did two rounds of the gun crew, and he was made my staff officer, and he was brilliant at going around begging, stealing, and borrowing stuff for us. And we started in that way. And I've always thought that I've been a benevolent sort of character, but everyone else tells me, no, you're not. That's the last thing you bloody well are. So I think it was fairly clear to everybody that we were going to do things my way. And that, when I mean everybody, I meant the captain of the air station as well as Commander Air. And if they used to query anything that I was doing in the early days and later on, I'd say, are you unhappy with what I'm doing with my squadron? And if they said, well, no, I said, well, that's it then. Please let me carry on my way. Oh, all right, Sharky. Don't need to get up like that. And it's happened quite a lot. And I said, well, either at one stage, Ministry of Defence sent me a signal during the, still on the IFTU, the trials unit, saying, you're doing too much fighter combat. Concentrate on the job in hand, hacking the Shadower, going to intercept shadowing aircraft. And of course, we hadn't got a radar by then, so we couldn't do any radar work and whatever. And so Charlie Sterling brought in the signal from MOD and said, hey, look, this is from DNAW, Sharky. You better respond to it and you better change a few things. So let me see it, Charlie. Right, take this down. I wrote back to the guy, to DNAW, copy everybody. If you don't like how I'm running this outfit, replace me. Otherwise, leave me alone. And guess what? They left me alone. Mm. And from there, we went on to invite F-15s from Bitburg, Germany, to come and fight against us. We'd already fought against the aggressor squadrons, the U.S. Aggressor squadrons, Alconbury, and beaten hell out of both the aggressors and the F-15 squadron, even without a radar, and only with a Sidewinder missile system. And they all said, what in hell is this aircraft? They said, this is something magical. And of course, it was something magical. It was brilliant in within visual range air combat. And I loved air combat. And I was taught air combat by people like Taylor Scott, who died in that Harrier going out over the North Sea, if you remember. He was a wonderful guy. And several others, Nutty Walters. People, air warfare instructors of great repute and great knowledge. And I started off at the bottom of the pile in the frontline squadrons and whatever, and slowly worked up. You don't get there straight away. But by the time I went to the Sea Harrier World at Yeovilton, I was number one fighter pilot as far as combat was concerned. And my main aim in life was to get all my pilots good at fighter combat before we got the radar. Let's make use of this aircraft. Let's get every bit of knowledge about how it handles and make the most out of this golden opportunity. And so that's what we did. We did a lot of combat, and that moved us easily into getting used to operating, well, firing weapons against targets, of course, bombs, you know, iron bombs, rockets, guns, but also missiles, but also getting so au fait with the aircraft that you could then operate this little radar, the Blue Vox, monopulse radar with your one hand, flying the aircraft with the other and thinking about operating with the rest of your brain, which wasn't very much. And it seemed to work like a charm because I had a very, very happy squadron. Whenever I suggested to them later on in life that I'd been a very benevolent commanding officer, they said, you must be effing joking. But they all loved me. Well, they loved being in my squadron, and I loved them because they were the best guys on earth. Never had any trouble from any of them. And I could rely on them completely. I didn't need to chase them. And I said to every one of them, this was my key when they joined, whether it was my second in command or most junior naval airman, I'd interview each one and say, look, you're coming here because you're good and because you've been chosen for this, which is now the premier air squadron in the Royal Navy as a flight trials unit. And I don't expect to have to tell you how to do your job, or watch over your shoulder to see you're doing it properly. And I will not do that. I say, if you make a mistake, and it's an honest mistake, I'm sure you'll learn from it, and you won't repeat it. But until you start making mistakes regularly of the same sort and the same kind, you're not going to hear from me unless you want anything. You want anything, you're unsure about anything, my door's always open. You come and see me and say, hey, boss, I've got this problem, or I don't understand this, or I'm worried about this. And we'll talk about it and get it done. Understood? And they say, yes, sir. I said, right, bugger off and get on with it. And my second in command, Tony Ogilvie, on the trials unit, he thought I was a complete lunatic. Because the usual crap you used to get when you joined a squadron, I want to see you on time and don't want any slacking, and I want you, you know, put everything into it. Well, of course they're going to do all that. You don't need to tell them that. And so I rapidly became well known as Mr. Sea Harrier, because anything to do with the Sea Harrier, I'd written all the instructions. I knew more about it than anybody else. I had the best team on earth working for me. And it was a natural progression through the headquarters squadron, which we formed next, and then 801 squadron, the frontline squadron, the second frontline squadron after 800, which I then commanded. And I kept this name, Mr. Sea Harrier, until going to the 801 squadron. But even then, I was known as Mr. Sea Harrier for a long time, even though I'd handed over my responsibilities as Chief Tactical Instructor, Sea Harrier. So from what I've been saying, you can already tell that I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder and probably still got it. And I loved it. Alex, it was just the most amazing part of my life. We had to go to Pebble Mill at one. We didn't have to go. I got a call from the Admiral's staff one day, right at the start of the trials unit, when I'd had about two trips in the new Sea Harrier. We had one Sea Harrier. And I think it was Neil Rankin then who was over there. And he said, hey, Sharky, the Admiral wants to know, can you land a Sea Harrier at Pebble Mill? Because the Air Force don't want to do it. They say it's too much of a risk. And I said, I think so, but give me a break. Give me 20 minutes and I'll call you back. He said, why? I said, well, I want to talk to John Farley. He's the Dunstroll test pilot, British Aerospace. He's the best guy at Harrier operations ever, you know, on handling and whatever. And I'll take his advice on whether to do it or not and how to do it. So I rang John Farley and got through to him, fortunately, and came back to Wing and to Neil Rankin and said, yeah, we can do it. He said, right, get your slippers on and come over and brief me when you've got it all organized, and me and the Admiral. And so I said, okay, done. So by the time I'd had six trips in this new Sea Harrier, I was then flying on my way to Birmingham to land at Pebble Mill at one on this pad that my lads had laid in the field next to the studio. And we'd shut down, we'd had to have the local zoo, which was right on the approach to the pad, with all the animals either sedated or moved so they didn't go crazy. And suddenly we'd arrive, we were in the press, we're on the front page of the Telegraph. Harrier lands at Pebble Mill, and there's this policeman with his hand up on the road outside, stopping the traffic while I'm going overhead too fast and too, you know, and just about making it and landing. And then First Sea Lord was there, of course, along with my Admiral, Ted Anson, brilliant guy, Ted Anson. Henry Leach was First Sea Lord. And he had a nice chat with me in the cockpit and said, Sharky, this is a big thing for the Navy, this. We're relying on you. I'm sure you're not going to let us down. Tell me more about the aircraft. So I told him about, you know, how the Harrier handles and what we plan to do with it and how we plan to do it. And he said, well, good luck. If you get any problems, refer directly to me, because I'm on your side and I'll back you up. And I thought, wow, that's wonderful. And that meant, you know, I was Mr. Sea Harrier. I had strong support from one of the best guys on earth. And indeed, Yeovilton supported us extremely well when we got going. And we had nothing but strong support from everybody all the way around, except for people like Boscombe Down, who said, well, you'll never be able to operate this aircraft at night, and you'll never be able to do this, and you'll never be able to do that, because it's too much for one pilot to do in a little aircraft like that, which is another story. But, of course, we did manage to do all those things and confound the test pilot world. It ended up with us all going to the Falklands in a hurry, knowing that we were totally outnumbered, and with the fleet in suffering from an umbrella of apprehension. I say in my book, fear. Fear pervaded the fleet, because everybody said there wasn't enough, we didn't have enough air power to oppose the 200-odd Argentine combat aircraft. And it was quite difficult, being Mr. C. Harrah, explaining to people and convincing them, which I did, my captain. I said, no, we're going to do this. But a lot of them, you know, we'd sit in the bar with the guys and they say, how on earth are you going to protect us? And so I said, well, this is how we do it. And don't worry, we're very good. And I have full confidence we're going to be able to make it work. And I wasn't lying through my teeth. I really believed it. So when we got down there, I was still acknowledged as Mr. C. Harrier. Before we got there, we were working up the squadron. We had to do all the trials that had not been done yet with the aircraft. This was 3 years into the aircraft, by the way. Well, 2.5. And Boscombe Downs still had not done any of the live weaponry trials, nearly 3 years in. So we embarked all the live weapons, and I sent up to my captain and then across to the flag a list of trials that 801 Squadron will carry out during the first week of the sail down south, which included everything, lay down bombing, 40-degree bombing, 10-degree bombing, strafing with the gun, missile work, air-to-air missile firings. So everything we could do, we were going to, we were tossing the leapers, tossing bombs, sort of 3 miles at a target. Every aspect of weaponry we were going to do in 1 week and prove it. And I said to the captain, yeah, this is what we've got to do this so we know everything's going to work fine. And he said, yeah, okay, go ahead. And so we did. In a week, we tested everything. Everything worked fine. We had good results. Remarkable results, really. And we got some help from ashore, from MOD, where they were sending us sight pictures. That's a picture you set on your sight, mm-hmm. A setting on the sight, to get the right result when you're attacking, let's say, a target with 20-degree with the rockets or guns. They sent us a sight picture which would have caused the weapons to land 400 yards away from the target. Whereas my boys did all the calculations on board, my air warfare instructors, and came up. We hit the target straight away and blew it out of the water with the first pod of rockets. So I feel now invigorated just thinking about how really dedicated we were to getting this right. And one of the things we were going to get right was we knew we would have to attack the airfield in Port Stanley and attack whatever aircraft were there. And I said, well, we've got to do it at night, not at dawn. We've got to do it at night. I've got 11 pilots, 10 of which I can get night qualified. Well, I'll try to get night qualified by the time we go. And 5 of which would be very, very, very capable of doing a night coordinated attack by the time we get down there. Because already I had sort of 70-odd night deck landings, and Ian Mortimer had about the same number, and we were starting to qualify Alan Curtis and Charlie Cantan and Steve Thomas. And so we revved up this program and then demonstrated with live weapons at night behind the carriers a night attack on Stanley, coordinated attack, which was ignored totally by Captain Middleton, the flag captain, who refused to operate with us, and said, no, what we're doing, we're going to attack at dawn, the old-fashioned way. So anyway, by the time we got down there, there was already this rift of interest. And so I said to my captain, J.J. Black, most wonderful man on earth, So, you've got a choice. You do it my way or the highway. If we do it the flag's way on what they're telling us to do, it won't work and we'll lose. So we're going to have to disobey flag's orders and do what I want. And JJ said, oh, he used to swear like anything. Oh, effing hell, Sharky. Are you sure? I said, yes, absolutely certain. He said, well, I'm not giving you carte blanche. When you want to countermand the flag's orders and do something different, then just let me know and tell me why. And if you've got a good point, that's what we'll do. And so we did. And he never once turned me down in what I wanted to do, which was different from the Admiral staff. And because of that, probably because of that, Admiral Sandy Woodward became a great friend of mine. Before he died, he told one of his colleagues, who's a friend of mine also, that if Sharkey hadn't disobeyed orders, we'd have lost the war. Well, we would have. The flag staff told us in Invincible and everywhere not to use the radar because they thought it was no good and it would let the enemy know where we were. And I said to JJ, we've got to use the radar, particularly to let the enemy know where we are, so they have to avoid us before they can get at their targets, because we're holding cap stations and we want to engage them, yeah, but we want to deter them as well. And straight away, JJ said, yeah, that's sensible. Right, you ignore the flag's instructions, use your radar, carry on. And there were several things like that going on. And we were down in the weeds, protecting the fleet on what we call cap stations, where up in the direction of the threat on southwest, west, and northwest, we had a pair of Sea Harriers all the time, we thought, from our squadron and Hermes' squadron. And they were supposed to be operating their radars full time. And the Argentines told us after the war was over that 450 or more strike sorties, missions by Argentine aircraft had voluntarily turned away because Sea Harriers were in the way. They could hear them on their radar warning receiver, or they occasionally saw us at low level while they were coming in low level. And they'd had strict instructions from their command. If you're going to meet the Sea Harrier, turn around, throw away your weapons and abort the sortie, because the Sea Harrier is very good at combat and you're going to lose. Which is the biggest mistake they made in the war. That's how we won the war, was we deterred, don't know how many bombs were on each strike aircraft. If there were four, that was 2,000 bombs. If there were two, that's 1,000 bombs that were not delivered against our ships in San Carlos and elsewhere. All because we used the radar, and we're down at low level, getting in the way of these guys. And also my guys, on my instructions, were going home with no more than 800 pounds of fuel on deck, which is lunacy. But we didn't lose an aircraft. No one ran out of fuel. And it meant we had another 20 minutes of protection for our ships in San Carlos and Falkland Sound that otherwise they wouldn't have had. So you can tell the way I'm going on. That's why they call me Mr. Sea Harrier. And that's why people say, you know, he's a bit sort of direct.
I have to say, I'd have thought with the whole lack of an airborne early warning,
yep,
that system, because despite the brilliant Sea King system, which was developed post-war, there was nothing pre-war and during the war. The keeping the radars on for the cap would have been sensible. You know, there was nothing else to provide that airborne cover.
So, absolutely, it was one of the biggest weaknesses we had. No airborne early warning. And it's one of the biggest weaknesses the new carriers will have with no airborne early warning, because they can't embark Hawkeye because of the ramp. But as you say, we could use our radar to detect aircraft inbound. Like, we got reports from ship's radar in Falkland Sound, say, or San Carlos, saying we got two high-level, high-speed targets approaching from the west. And there you are, sitting above East Falkland on way to Cap Station. On the radar, you pick up a Mirage at 20-odd miles. Better than not having a radar and seeing nothing. And then later, the only reason I managed to shoot down a Hercules was because in Falkland Sound, they got an intermittent contact 40 miles northwest, and I was just leaving for home. I said, right. I turned on to use the radar, picked it up straight away, a nice fat target, and didn't lose it after that. We chased it. It turned away. It knew it had been in. And so, yeah, without airborne and early warning, we could have lost the war. We didn't. But it was, like Sandy said, you know, a close-run thing. And it was a critical lack of capability that was one of the major lessons from the Falklands, which no other navy has ever suffered from. Well, the Americans, they never suffer from lack of airborne early warning. They take it with them. Another thing we had no air-to-air refueling. The modern strike carrier has air-to-air refueling. With the American Navy, it's mainly buddy-buddy refueling with the Super Hornet. And there are other things that we lacked, like onboard air delivery and stuff like that. But the main thing was, look-down capability in our radar. We couldn't look down over the land. We could look down over the sea. Indeed, I picked up a shoal of killer whales, which I thought was a submarine periscope one day, and went in to attack it with guns until I could see that these killer whales breaking the water, cavorting through the water north of East Falkland. I thought, wow, what a beautiful picture. And then I said, who says this bloody radar doesn't work? You know, that was against a fairly calm sea. But we could see ships, a trawler out to well over 100 miles. Well, 100 miles was the limit of our radar, but it was every ship within 100 miles we could see. But we couldn't see aircraft down over land. And sadly, our Type 42 radars, they couldn't see aircraft over the land so easily. And so that was a severe limitation for us. If we'd had the FA-2 Sea Harrier with the Blue Vixen and AMRAAM, we would have only needed two aircraft airborne continuously over East Falkland to protect, to ensure air superiority and airspace denial. That's how good the FA-2 was and is with AMRAAM. But we didn't have that. And so one of the major lessons coming out of the Falklands War, that's what we needed on board our carriers, a really good look-down, shoot-down, long-range, beyond visual range kill capability, which was provided with the FA-2, air-to-air refueling, airborne early warning, very much so, airborne early warning. Those are the main sort of key things that we really need. And, of course, we're not getting air-to-air refueling or airborne early warning with our new carriers because some idiot decided to fit a ramp to it.
Yes, although, well, with airborne early warning, it seems to me they're going for the traditional methodology. You know,
yes.
The helicopter system, which is, it's nice to keep to the British-based system, but it might have been more sensible to have gone the Qatar option, but the wisdoms of the Treasury Department will always be by Byzantine.
It's not. Let me first say the Crow's Nest was going to be an adaptation of the F-35 radar. Mm-hmm. They've changed that, apparently, and they're going to just jig up the Seeking Mark 7 radar, AEW radar. And that just isn't actually good enough for what we need as a strike carrier. It's nowhere near as good or capable as a Hawkeye. And so when your reference to Treasury matters, there's no balance in the UK. The UK is totally stupid on defence matters. Why did we not put cat and trap on? It was going to cost up to £2 million. Fine. What were we spending at the same time on obsolete aircraft like the Tornado and then on also now on Typhoon? 10 Typhoons. That's 1,300 million dollars, right? Mm-hmm. That's almost a cot of cat and trap. And we should have done that. And then we would be able to embark a full air group at half the price of the F-35. And I'm talking about not just the Super Hornet itself, but the Growler and also the Hawkeye. We could have had the proper air group with air-to-air refueling, the whole thing, half the price of what we're doing now with the F-35 Stovall. which in itself might not work and is nowhere near as capable as the air group I've just described. So,
and
Treasury,
we could have had the U-class as well, the new stealth.
Absolutely, and what we've done by fitting a ramp is stopping us having all these wonderful new pilotless vehicles that can save lives and can go a hell of a long bloody way delivering weapons or finding out information, you know? The stupidity of... Well, it's not... You can't really blame the politicians if they're not advised properly. And they weren't advised properly by the senior members of the MOD. Now, if we'd gone F-35C, the conventional F-35, we could have then easily, like the American Navy's doing now, said, no, let's get some Super Hornets instead. And if the F-35 thing doesn't work out that well, we'll wait until it does, and then maybe we'll buy some then. That's financial logic.
I think... And we'll get back to the Falklands. Well, here's a question, because this is a question I always like to put to my pilots. What was the Sea Harrier like to fly? What was the FA-1 like to fly as an aircraft? Because you've been over it, but, you know, this is a question for those who'll never fly it like me.
Well, first of all, let's just put it in perspective. Flying modern jets, going from the Hunter to the Sea Vixen, which wasn't particularly modern, to the Phantom, was fantastic, and the power in the Phantom was huge. But eventually, once you'd done everything you could with the aircraft and done, you know, all the different types of attack and training and whatever, and now you're training other guys, you tended to get a little bit bored with boring holes in the sky sometimes, because it can be very boring if you're on cap duty or whatever, or you're doing the same thing time and time again. And then along comes a Harrier, and you are asked to jump in this aircraft because you're going to fly it. And the first thing you do is you jump in it, and they say, right, you want you to do a vertical takeoff and landing, and this is what you need to do with the throttles and the nozzle lever. And you go off on your own in a single-seat Harrier, taking off vertically and then landing on the same pad again. Bloody amazing, because you put the power, you hit the nozzles down, do as they say, hit the full power, and you're up off the deck. And it's totally manageable, because they wouldn't send you off in bad conditions. And you go up and they say, right, that's high enough, and so you ease back on the throttle, and you stabilize the height, and you look around you and you say, wow, this is amazing. They say, right, now can you see the markers down below you, which marking the way you've got to come down to on the pad, because you can't see the pad, it's underneath you. I said, yeah, we've got the markers. Right. Take off a bit of power and then reapply it. And so you take it off, reapply it, and the momentum down continues. You say, right, keep it coming down, keep it coming down. And you can maneuver the aircraft backwards and forward with a stick, just like you would normally do with the nozzles down. And keep on the markers, then as you hit the ground, snap the throttle shut. That should be in your first trip in a Harrier. That's amazing. But what's even more amazing is going to sea in a Harrier. And I did that the first time in the front seat, which is not the main seat, onto Hermes for Hermes trials of the Sea Harrier, FRS-1. And I'm used to flying into the deck to land on a carrier at 135 knots, something like that, indicated airspeed, and with wind over the deck and so on, you're coming in at about 110 miles an hour relative to the ship. And it's like going down a tunnel towards these little wires on the deck, which suddenly get very large, and the ship gets large, and whoosh, you miss the wires, and you go through past the superstructure and go around again. None of that with the Harrier. It's totally... I couldn't believe it. My mind couldn't cope with it, because I'd got a fair number of deck landings under my belt with conventional. And here we are coming in. And he said, right, now we're going to transition to the hover from a position on the glide slope. And instead of carrying on down, we sort of level out and the nozzles are down and the aircraft starts slowing down. And the ship approaches, but gets the speed of approach is lower and lower until suddenly you're sitting there by the side of the ship, by the side of the island, hovering on this power. And there's no crunch on deck. There's no, everything's easy. And the guy, he says, right, take it across over the deck, take off the power a bit, on again, down we go, thud, you land on deck. Bob's your uncle. Now, that was an amazing experience compared for a conventional pilot. And let me just say that that is the simplest bit of it all. With the Harrier, we learnt at Wittering while we were doing a conversion, and with the Sea Harrier, you could do about 7 or 8 different landings on the airfield without using the runway. And so you had to be all awake in your head when you're doing a Harrier deck landing, because it was also dangerous if you didn't get the wind ahead of you. A killer, in fact. So going from Phantom to Harrier was remarkable, and it was a challenge. And the challenge kept going, because you've now gone to single seat from twin seat. So you've got all the problems of managing the whole weapon system, the radar and whatever, but also a sometimes temperamental aircraft that could kill you if you didn't treat it properly. So it was out of this world. And if you were going up there, if they took you down on a conventional deck landing first, and then on a Harrier deck landing, you would enjoy both. You say, wow, the conventional deck landing was superb. And wow, this is superb in a different way. And you wouldn't quite understand the difficulty of either, but you love it. It's amazing. I mean, something I'll never forget, and I'll always feel grateful that I was able to do.
And how is it like flying in combat? How is it like sort of handling this aircraft in combat? You've already said you had advantages and you'd already done a huge amount of training, and to personally get your squadron up to definitely a combat squadron, but how is it like?
Well, in real combat or just in normal practice combat?
In real combat, in the Falklands.
Well, we didn't get much real combat in the Falklands. We got engagements where we came into contact with the other aircraft, and usually they try to run away and you'd go behind them and shoot them down. But the first thing to say would be, in combat, you get airborne, you go over the land, like I did on day one, near Port Stanley, trying to chase a Matador, which I hit, by the way, in cloud. It didn't go down. And the next thing you know, you're getting tracer bullets up at you from the ground. That's a big shock, because suddenly you can see someone's firing at you. And you say, yeah, shit, you know, I don't like this. and so the first day is something to get used to. And the apprehension you feel before your first combat sortie is there. But it rapidly disappears. You realize that tracer bullets, you might be able to see them, but they're hardly ever going to hit you. And it's a baptism, not of fire, but it's an interesting baptism that you have to go through. But basically, after day one, most people are over it. Until the time you come up against an aircraft that's going to fight you. Now, we didn't really get that. They all tried to get away until the 21st, when Steve and I came across these 3 Mirages. Actually, there were 4, but we only saw 3 of them. No, there were 3. Yeah. And I saw them first at low level over Falkland, West Falkland, west of San Carlos. And I called out coherently, I thought, to Steve. He said, I couldn't understand a fucking word you said, boss. Because I was really adrenaline rush. Wow. There, I said, these 2 diamond shapes low over the hills ahead, told him the direction. I'm going for them now. Oh, they're turning towards me. They've seen me. And so these 2 diamond shapes were Dagger aircraft. And so I, instead of thinking, switch on the guns and try and hit them head on, or try and acquire them with a head-on missile shot, because it was all happening so fast. I was commenting on what I was doing, I thought, telling Steve what I was doing. I said, I'm flying through them now. Now, this was down about 50 feet, and I went through between both of them and said, right, I'm turning hard starboard because I think they'll turn port to get at San Carlos. So as I turned hard starboard, because all this time I'd been putting on power because we were operating at low power to save fuel, and I turned really hard, and I realized they turned the other way because I was looking over my shoulder and said, Steve, they turned the other way. Where are you? Oh, I can see you. Right, you're on their tail. And Steve said, yeah, I got them, boss. And he let loose the first missile after the first one. And while that was going on, I thought, wow, this is fantastic. I saw Steve's missile go off. And the guy in the mirage that he was firing at, I saw the canopy of the seat go out just before the missile hit, and the aircraft, the back end of the aircraft, exploded in a ball of flame. And then he had a fire at the second one, which was now in full burner, running away from him, because these were the two aircraft I'd passed between. And he fired his missile, and I watched it. And just as the aircraft was pulling up into the cloud, must have been about a mile and a quarter away by now, mile and a half, the little white dot was the sidewinder, was trying to pull up after him, and then it just exploded underneath the aircraft before it went into cloud, but not close enough, I think, to get a kill. But it actually did destroy the aircraft eventually. While this was going on, Sharky had forgotten all his training about look out for the third. The next thing I knew, I'm talking, saying, well done, Steve, that's fantastic. And I look down, and I'm low. I'm not 50 feet, but I'm about 100 feet. There's this beautiful dinky toy of a Mirage Dagger, all with its camouflage, flying underneath me. And I find out later, after the war, that he'd been firing at me with his cannon but missed and had overtake. And as he turned and headed west and tried to run, put in burner, I dropped down behind him, fired my missile, and watched him explode. He actually got out. I didn't see him get out, but what I did see was the whole aircraft broke into pieces as the sidewinder hit it. It went again over the spine. And the next thing I knew, I was watching a section of one wing, cartwheeling along the ground, and there's just debris everywhere from this guy. And it was real adrenaline pumping stuff. And I thought, well done, Steve. We got three. Well, we got two and a possible, but probably three. Let's get back on station, because we'd moved a little to the west. I came up and I said, and I was talking to Antrim, the controller in San Carlos Water. I said, all right, control, what else you got for us? We just splashed three Mirages. And the guy, Leon Hume, who you now know, Leon, he says, wait. And typical me, I feel like saying, don't tell me to fucking well wait, boy. I said, no, you don't understand me. We've just splashed three Mirages. We want more trade. Is there any more trade? He said, wait. The guy across the desk from me has just had half his head blown off. We've been hit by one that got away. By a strafing mirage. I said, oh, Jesus, I'm terribly sorry. And so we headed back towards where I was supposed to go. And then I said, Steve? And they looked like three seagulls cavorting around ahead. I said, are those seagulls over San Carlos or over Falcon Sound? No, bugger it. They're A4s. They've stopped circling now, and they're going south. They're going south after Ardent, because I knew Ardent was down there smoking. She'd been hit already. So I set off at high speed, said, follow me. Let's try and get them before they get to Ardent. And their adrenaline is still pumping. Steve had got no missiles left, just guns. I'd got one missile left. And we went at low level, very high speed. Soon we were doing 630 knots over settlements and whatever. And as we broke out over Falkland Sound, there in front of me, Well before that, I'd called Red Section, who I realized were above San Carlos from Hermes, to come down and to attack these guys. And as I came out over the water, Red Section was coming down, did get in behind them, and they shot down two of the three, or three of the four, two of the three, I think. And the third one hit the masts of Ardent as it went through and eventually was lost. But at that stage, I was sucked. That means too far away to do anything myself. But it was just like Cinerama, Walt Disney, watching this bloody thing happen in front of me. Spaghetti Morelli, Clyde Morell, he got one of them with guns, and I saw the aircraft explode. I thought, bloody incredible. This was about 2 miles away from me because they're quite small, a mile and a half. Then I looked around. I said, all right, Steve. I got no reply. I said, Steve, where are you? You know, a bit frosty when my number two wasn't around. No number two. And I thought, Jesus Christ. Steve? No reply. Then Roger, Antrim, I think I might have lost my number two. I'm going back up my track over West Falcon, see if I can see him. Listen out on the Sabi beacon, see what you can hear. And I went back up the track. Couldn't see a sign of Steve anywhere. and waited as long as I could until I was running out of fuel, and set off back home for Invincible. And I was very, very sad, because I thought Steve had gone down. And Antrim said, we're sending a helicopter over to look for him. And I was about 100 miles off Invincible. Beautiful, brilliant day. I could see the ship 100 miles away, a little dot with a bit of foam behind it. And I called up and I said, hey, this is whatever my call sign was. I was Sharky or whatever. I got some bad news. Good news is we splashed 3 Mirages. Bad news, I think I lost my number 2. I think he's gone down. They said, no, no, no. Your number 2's landing on board right now with a radio failure. And he had actually been hit in the radio bay with gunfire from the ground, with machine gun fire. Lost his radio, couldn't speak to me. And when I spoke to him when I got down, I said, what the fuck, how do you think you were doing? He said, well, boss, we all know you can look after yourself. I thought, well, I got no missiles left, no radio. I'm going to bugger off home, get it fixed. And I thought, good on you, mate. Good on you. So that was the only time we got any real combat going. It was interesting firing guns at the Hercules and at the Picara. Does that indeed combat? But they were just trying to get away. And the Picara man, Tomba, was so bloody brave. He stayed with it. Well, I put all 240 rounds of HE and ammunition into him before he got out, and the aircraft went into the mud. So the whole thing was very exciting, but for the most part, the Falklands was sitting on cap, trying to deter the enemy, doing it, staying down there as long as you can, then having a bit of worry on the way back to the ship in case you're going to run out of fuel, and occasional night sorties, which in wintry conditions, which were very testing and demanding. But for the most part, I won't say boring. It was never boring, but it was less than riveting when you were just out on cap trying to do your thing, because you were always listening to the ships that needed your support. And I hardly say fortunately, to be there over Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram when they were being hit the second time. Well, I was actually 10 miles to the south. And so I had a lot of interesting stuff to see. And throughout the war, I allowed myself 5 minutes each day to think about my family. And much more of that, to be frustrated about the flag and the Admiral's staff. It wasn't the Admiral's fault. It was the ship's captain just didn't like Sea Harrier, basically. And that used to give me great frustration. I was like battling another enemy at the same time. But at the same time, we had J.J. Black and Dusty Milner on board. J.J. in particular was just a most amazing captain. Sense of humor all the way through the war. Kept the ship's company content when we had our guys, well, not our guys, the radar room guys were on board 4 hours off, 4 hours on for 60 days. Can you believe it? Four on, four off, never complaining. And when it was all over, while we were saying goodbye to the other carrier and the Admiral in a steam past, you know, they came out with this huge sign along the side of the deck, there and back with J.J. Black, and they had T-shirts to match. They loved J.J. Black, the ship's company, and my squadron did too. He was an amazing man, and he'd seen action before in Borneo. And so he used to say, he was very laconic about it. He'd say, what's the point of running from one side of bridge to the other? That might be where the bloody thing hits. Just relax, you know? And he'd seen somebody killed next to him in Borneo. And he said, well, there's no point in running around dithering and thinking you might get hit. Just get on with the job. And accused me many times of blowing smoke up his ass, which was, well, most times he was right, but I never let him know it. But we had a fantastic arrangement. It was that was terrific. That was fantastic. But when I finished, I was dead. Walking like the walking zombie. I was totally without energy. Lost a lot of weight. Feeling grey, totally grey. I wasn't totally grey yet, but I was feeling totally and utterly done by the time I left Port Stanley for a trip home by Hercules. And it took quite a long time, more than I realized at the time, to get over the effort that had been put in, because it was the effort that was going in that was the taxing thing. It was 100% effort by my team all the time. No let up. And the guys were just absolutely brilliant. Dick Goodenough's team, the engineers. We did 600 tasks, 600 sorties, missions completed out of 602 that we'd been asked to do. That's my squadron. And we had an average of 6 aircraft. And that's the engineers for you. They were absolutely brilliant. And for most of the time, the aircraft were in pristine condition. Serviceable and ready to go, and so it was a combination of boys' own fantastic combat and frustration, hard work, and eventually elation with success, because we did win. And we won against all odds. And when I met this guy called Russian general in East Berlin from on the staff course later, and General Zed, his name was, and he said, "Oh, we thought you British were going to get your bottom smacked, but only you, the British, could have gone down there 8,000 miles with so few air resources and won the game." He says, "You know, we were watching you closely in Russia, and we thought you were brilliant. Well done." And that was because of my boys, because of the Sea Harrier, enabled the Marines, paratroopers, Scots Guards, Welsh Guards, and Gurkhas to do their business. I mean, they won the war on the land, that's for sure. We enabled them to do that by deterring and combating the air threat against us. And for 200 against 20, it wasn't a bad job done. Interestingly, I got an email from the Battle of Britain Society just after the end of the war. It said, "From the few to the very few, well done."
Sharky, I have a feeling you're not also a known friend of many commanding officers. I can imagine you've caused many to get grey hair early.
I've got a lot of friends and a lot of, I won't call enemies, of people who say, you know, on the other side. But I've had some first-class commanding officers who, like Nick Carr in the Phantom World, who let me have a run of Bill Pepe in the first part of my Phantom time. I call commanding officers like Neil Rankin, first of all on board Invincible as Commander Air, then at Yeovilton. Brilliant guy. Mike Rawlinson, captain of Yeovilton. Absolutely brilliant. Gave me a free hand, allowed me to do what I wanted. So, yeah, I've fallen out with some commanding officers, like the ones in DNAW when I was first there. But I had no respect for people who didn't respect me and what I'd done, or what I was capable of, you know. And, you know, read my book, you'll find out what happened, why I told the guy to bog off, basically.
Well, that is something we will talk about in a bit. We'll definitely put a plug in for your book at the end of this. Next question, and this is possibly a strange question, but it's one I wanted to ask, especially someone who was a squadron commander. Did your experience of commanding a squadron change when you were commanding in wartime versus the peacetime and the trials squadron experience? Did it change? Was it a different experience being command when you've had the pressures of combat and war?
No, it didn't. It may have done for some people. I suspect it did on some ships. But because I trusted my guys completely during the peacetime process, which was unusual. I mean, I used to go home at between 5 and 5.30 each day from the time I became commander of the IFTU to the time I was commander of 801 Frontline Squadron. And I used to get a phone call from Commander Air or the captain every day after 5.30 asking to speak to me. And my guys, the staff office, would say, "Sorry, he's gone home, sir." And they used to say, "Why weren't you there?" I used to get called over in sort of almost swords and medals, as to explain. I said, because I don't need to be there. Is there something wrong with my squadron? Are my guys not doing a good job? Are we not the best? Have we not won all the prizes? And they'd say, well, yes. I said, well, then please don't complain about how I run my squadron. And I run my squadron by going home, leaving them to it when they can be left to it, and supporting them when they need it. And so they were support. They had had my total support, my guys did, total loyalty. And I expected high standards from them. There's no question of that. You know, when I got six aircraft out of six on the line each morning, I got used to it and I expected it. But I didn't come down on them when they didn't get it, but they knew that that's what the boss wants and what he's going to get. And so when we went to war, I expected the same high standards to prevail because they were these guys I went to war with in 801. Many of them had followed me through the trials unit through 899 squadron, the headquarters squadron, and now 801. So we knew each other backwards, and it was like a family affair. They knew what the job was. They did absolute wonders because it's all right being a pilot jumping into the air and fighting, you know, and going into combat. What's it like sitting on deck wondering when you're going to get hit by an exocet or an airstrike and still trying to do your job? Long, long hours with no respite. That's what these guys lived through, and they produced amazing results, as did all the lads on board HMS Invincible. They loved their captain. Their captain let them get on with it. I mean, we were very much alike in one sense, and that is he allowed you to get on with your job. And I didn't learn that from him, but I admired that in him fully because that's the way I decided to run my own squadron. So going to war was not a difficult transition of squadron practices. The end of the war was a little more different because during the war, I ignored all orders if I needed to, including Maggie Thatcher's rules of engagement, which were ridiculous, written by lawyers for lawyers. And I tore them up and threw them in the waste paper basket, told the captain that's what I'd done, and said, my squadron will do what I say. And he said, yeah, be it on your own head, Sharky. I said, yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the war, I was airborne, and I was on cap, like we were not round San Carlos anymore. We were near the fleet. And the controller came up and said, Sharky, weapons tight. I meant you can't fire anything. I said, why? What's up? What's happening? I said, acknowledge weapons tight. Yeah, I acknowledge it. Weapons tight. What's happening? And they said, the war's over, Sharky. They've surrendered, you know? Jesus, I can still remember it. It's a moving moment, you know? And I thought, wow. And I got back on board, and within 24 hours, everything had changed. It was all back to bureaucratic stupidity of peacetime rules and regulations. And seeing, you know, people thinking about when are we going to get home, when are we going to do this, when are we going to do that, and then being told, well, the ship isn't going to go home until September, and this was June the 14th, because Hermes is going home now, because there had to be one first, and they decided it's Hermes. And so the squadron's going to be down here with the ship until that time, carrying out air defense work from Port Stanley and from the ship in case there's more to be done. But to me, it was like the war's over. My job's practically over. I'm going to be relieved at the end of July. They want to send me to Staff College. And I said, I don't want to go to Staff College. And they say, you're going.
It was probably about time. You know, you had all the staff work.
I did the junior staff college. And by the way, I when I went to staff college, David Pentreath was the director, new director, and he was captain of Plymouth during the Falklands. Plymouth went through a really good war. And I came equal top at Staff College. I should have been top, I felt. And I threw a wobbly and asked the director why I wasn't top, because some bloody helicopter pilot had marked my lessons learned from the Falklands paper down a bit. And here me telling me about lessons learned from the air war in the Falklands. And I really gave him a hard time. And David Bendry said, "Doug Sharkey, calm down. You got the director's prize. You're equal top. You can't get much better than that." But it was still a reflection of what I would call a very mild piece of that syndrome, traumatic stress syndrome, that I realized many years later that had affected me in a little way and would show itself in little ways. I mean, when I said to you just now, the war's over. Again, you know, I'm almost in tears. I don't know why. I can't stop it. It's so moving that at the end of that period in my life, it was suddenly finished. And it's a laugh, really. I mean, if you talk of Sharkey, the real Sharkey Ward, he'd laugh and say, "Stop being such a wet blanket," you know. But there are some things that happen that I really can't control still as a result of what happened down there. And I wasn't in fact, I wasn't in any personal danger at all, apart from, you know, the combat bit, which it didn't really register as personal danger. It was just doing the job. And, but yeah, a lot of stress. Well, my number two, Robin Kent, brilliant guy, Buccaneer pilot, then Harrier pilot, senior pilot of the squadron down there. He left the Navy sometime after getting back. Took a degree. He'd never taken A-level, so he did a year's A-level support work. Got accepted for exceptional results by Brighton University as the best university for psychology in Britain. And is now, in rapid return, went through BSc, MSc, BA, MA, PhD. He's a PhD, and he's now looking after PTSD victims from, not from the Falklands, from everywhere. And he's given the, he's got the responsibility of listening to the case and then deciding which would be the best psychologist to take care of this patient. So he's done so well, and quite remarkable. And so I said to him, "Well, why don't you, while he's at university, when I'm over in England this next time, why don't you take me down to Brighton and use me as an example on the stage for your students?" And he said, "Sharkey, if you were on the stage and opened your mouth, after 2 minutes, they'd all want to lynch you. They wouldn't want to hear what you have to say." He said, "You just don't understand these people. They're a totally different world from you." I said, "Oh, okay, forget that one then." So, yeah, your question was the, was it different as a commanding officer? It was only different at the end of the war. I didn't lose interest in the squadron, but I'd already fallen out with Commander Dusty over our attempts to go close to the Argentine mainland. And he hadn't really forgiven me for that. So we were still on first name terms, just. But that was about it. And that hurt me a lot. I felt that badly. It's my fault, but I think I was justified, but it still hurt me a lot. And then leaving, going home, being treated like the least important person on the aircraft by the RAF, and then getting to Bryce Norton and not being allowed in with the VIP soldiers who'd just been fighting the war into their reception in front of the family was something that I couldn't take. I completely effing exploded in front of the group captain and said, "How many wing commanders you got around here?" I said, "Get three of them." I said, and he said, "Oh, yes, 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 yes," because he suddenly realized, because I was in uniform. And he suddenly realized that his staff sergeant made a mistake with handing the front of chest to Sharky Ward and saying, you can't come in, this is for VIP Falcon veterans only. I said, you, go and get my father-in-law's car. You, go and get my wife's car. You, escort us in for a drink. Thanks, crew captain, and no thanks. So he went in and had a drink, and I was fucking furious. But that was the RAF. I wasn't allowed off the aircraft first, as I should have been, but I wouldn't want to go off before the injured. There were a couple of injured people on board. I would have insisted they got off first, but then as the senior officer on board, I should have been next. But they asked me to remain seated, not to get off until everyone else was off the aeroplane, including, and outside there were generals meeting the soldiers, and there were some Falkland Islanders, and then at the end I was allowed off, and there was no one there. I had to walk across a hard standing to this small group of family still left there, with everybody was inside. It was an insult I'll never forget from the effing crabs. I hope this goes on the air, because now they'll understand what a load of waz I had to put up with from the Royal Air Force. And
that's a shame, that one. And I'm sorry to hear that. That doesn't seem to me the right kind of reception at all.
Well, guess what? Guess what? Mike Clapp went home, Commander Amphibious Forces, wasn't met by anybody, Navy or anybody else.
No. He's told me that story. Next question, and this is going to be... Well, this is a question which I've been thinking about while we've been talking. How did you structure the operations of the Sea Harrier? Because there's always been these debates going on about where the caps were flown, whether they were flown in the right place. I would like to get your opinion on that.
Okay. Well, on the way down, I got my top team together. There's John Eaton Jones, who lost his life. He's an air warfare instructor. Ian Mortimer was my air warfare instructor, RAF. We trained him. Alan Curtis was from the RAF, had been RAF Vulcan pilot, had gone to fly A4s in New Zealand and was now with my squadron flying Harriers, a brilliant guy. And who have I forgotten? Robin Kent, senior pilot. Said, right, we're going to war. We want to know how to play it. What do we do? Where do we put the cap? What do we recommend to the command about where the fleet is? I want all your thoughts. This was very early on. I want you to go away, work as a team, and come up with your recommendations so we can then put them all together and recommend to the captain, who can then recommend them to the staff. And most of it was fairly straightforward. All of us would have said, well, we're going to have to carry out combat air patrol, air defense of the fleet. Because they've got 200 aircraft, apparently. They're going to attack us and try and sink us, and we need to defend ourselves. So we had to protect the fleet first, not just with a combat air patrol up threat, 100 miles up threat or 70 miles up threat, but also with the position of the fleet. And I said, the fleet has got a choice. This is what we came up with. We either meet them head on and have a big, big, big air battle, which I'm glad we didn't do, because eventually we'd have lost by going inside the Falklands close to Argentina and say, come and get us if you can. Or we stand off a long way and do it the hard way, standing off and protecting our forces by flying inshore from where the fleet eventually was. But it wasn't just that we had to do. We said, well, how do we engage enemy aircraft? And, for example, we knew that if they were wise, they would send quite a lot of aircraft against us at one time. They could do it by day or by night. So we practiced our intercept maneuvers, and there's a thing called the hook maneuver, where one aircraft goes around the back, one goes head on, and you sandwich the threat, and then fly through the threat, and then come back in again. And two of you can fight against six quite well, or eight, because there's only two of you. And if you know what you're doing, you can do this at night, and they don't know what's happening. And so we were good at that. We could do it at night. And guess what? On the first day of the war, this hook maneuver, so there's Steve Thomas and Paul Barton, Steve is my number two, but he was flying with Paul then because I'd been flying at night. They got these Mirages coming down from height at them, and there was going to be an engagement. So they did the hook maneuver. Paul went round the back. Steve, who had got the first contact, was going to go head on because he had contact. Paul then got contact. He went round the back. They were then flying upwards, these guys coming down, and it worked out perfectly. Paul got visual on this Mirage coming past him from the hook, shot him down in a ball of flame, and Steve couldn't get an acquisition on the Mirage that's coming down head on, but then turned around, flew around like that as this guy went down for the clouds and fired a missile in the vertical, which impacted the aircraft just before it went into the clouds. That was Steve's third kill, his first kill, actually, rather than the two later ones. And so that was, we'd practiced this and briefed this. We were used to doing this sort of maneuver by day and by night, believe it or not. And so that was just part of the planning that we said, well, this is how we're going to do the nitty-gritty. We're going to run, you know, like a strafing attack, really, but air-to-air. If there are a lot of them, we'll go in and we'll fire head-on, head-on, fly through, fly around, watch where we are, know where we are, and come back in and attack them again and again. And if they manage to sort their mess out and sort out who we are and attack us, well, good for them. So the aim was to be ready to receive a large number of aircraft in the attack. And as soon as we knew we had such an attack coming, to launch standby aircraft on the deck to follow up from the two already airborne, because the two airborne would have two missiles each and 240 rounds of cannon. That's it. So the next two guys would be going up. And if we could scramble any more, we would do so. And so this was passed on upwards as the way we were going to fight the battle, and based on having a cap position of two aircraft under three quarters, northwest, west, and southwest, because we were far enough away that they wouldn't be able to move round the back. And that was the principle on which we worked initially. But we also said when the San Carlos was chosen as a landing site, which was a long way in, well, we're going to do the same thing for that. It's going to be a lot more pressing for us because we've got to go further and we've got to operate at low level, whereas over the sea we'd be operating at 12,000 feet, which is a bit of a help. Our radars would work quite well, but we're going to get overland at low level so we could see them above the horizon coming in. But with the same intent. By then we'd realize they're not going to attack in great numbers. And so the planning was good. It worked out. It was everything we proposed could have worked well. We proposed the dawn attack, not the dawn attack, the night attack on San Carlos. They wouldn't do that. And when they did the same dawn attack 4 days later, 3 days later, and Taylor was killed in that attack over Goose Green, I was furious. I said, you know, they're so fucking predictable, this staff. How can you send in, do the same attack you did on day one on the airfield and on Goose Green, do the same thing, the same way, at the same time? Look what we've done. We lost a young pilot who shouldn't have been lost at all. And I got a remark from the staff aviation officer. Well, that's war. You have to expect these things. And I say, my God, to my captain, I said, those effing people over there need to be shot, you know. That's not proper warfare. That's just stupidity. Your question is, you know, that's how we planned from the start. We put a lot of thought into it before we got down there. How we got each contingency we planned for, and we practiced what we preached. And if it didn't fit in with what the admiral's staff wanted, not the admiral, but the admiral's staff, the flag captain and so on, we ignored what he wanted, and we did it our way, and it worked out good. You know, I'm very proud of the fact that my squadron and Invincible together made a big difference in the outcome of the war.
And I have to say, I do find some of these things surprising, because of course the Royal Navy was in the 1930s and Second World War were the night combat and night warfare experts, who of course demonstrated this with Taranto in Italy. To have someone talking then about a dawn raid, which is sort of First World War ideals of air combat, it seems to be, as I said, rather strange.
Yes. Did you know, you also knew, I'm sure, that the Fleet Air Arm in the 30s did all the homework and the spade work for the famous Pathfinder Squadron.
All right. This is sort of usually one of the questions I sort of try to end, well, start the end of the podcast with. And this is, it's what lessons had you learnt by the end of the war that you wish you'd known beforehand?
Oh, that's a very unusual question. That wish we'd known beforehand. Well, they're not earth-shattering ones, but there are one or two. In particular, as Mr. C. Harrier, I had ensured with Dick Goodenough and his predecessor, Palmer, engineer officers, we had brought out reports on everything we'd done, all the trials, all the results, on the trials unit, the headquarters squadron, and beyond. Everything to do with the aircraft, we'd put on paper and sent to the right authorities, like our admin authority, FONAC, FOF 3, that's Flag Officer Flitter 3, the seaborne side of it, Ministry of Defence, Boscombe Down, everybody. They all had full copies of all our trials and results. And I had sort of believed they might have taken some note of that. But when we got down there, we found that the Admiral, well, he's told me many times, Sandy, he said, I knew nothing about the Sea Harrier. Nothing had been published about it to educate the Navy and the seaman officers. And they basically, the surface fleet knew very, very little about the Sea Harrier. On top of that, I didn't actually know how little 800 Squadron had progressed with their radars. They got their radars before us. And while they were still at Yeovilton, while I was headquarters squadron. So in the headquarters squadron, we got some radars. Then 800 got them. Then 801 later got them. And they were having some troubles, we gathered, with setting up their radars. And so I sent across, I said, Dick, send your best guys over to have a word with 800 and offer them any help they need concerning setting up the radars, because we've got to make sure they can work as well as ours can, and etc. I got a stiff, starchy reply from 800 saying, we don't need your help. We can manage on our own, thank you. And I thought, oh, okay. And I wish I'd realized then what poor results they were actually getting, not just from their radar, but from their navigation kit. And they were only picking up a Sea Harrier target at 7 miles in the air, whereas we were picking up every time at 23 miles. Well, the Sea Harrier is a small target. We could pick up a civil airliner at 80 miles away. They couldn't. And their reception of the detection of targets was so poor that they lost interest in their radar and the use of it for air defense. At the same time, their navigation kit wasn't working properly because they weren't setting it up properly. And whereas we would get about 1 mile error in 500 miles flown, they were getting huge errors, and so they didn't trust their navigation system. Guess what? The navigation system also provides information to the weapon system. So we had there a squadron that refused to admit that it needed help, that went to sea in Hermes, demonstrating very poor capability compared to what they should have done. This meant that when we went to sea and said what we could do, Lynn Middleton, who was the captain, the flag captain of Hermes, wouldn't believe what we were saying. He thought it was bullshit, you know? And actually many other people questioned the difference between the two squadrons as to what they were claimed to be capable of. And I wish I'd known before the war that there was such a disparity in capability between the squadrons, and that there was such low information turnout about Sea Harrier, because this was our new only long-range air defense capability and our only long-range reconnaissance capability. And it's a fleet capability, which is very important. And the fleet didn't understand it at all, hadn't been told about it at all, even though DNAW, DNW, and all these people in MOD had all the information and should have been passing it on to Sink Fleet, who should have been passing it on to the ships. So basically, we had to train up all the ships, and we weren't allowed to train up 800 Squadron because they thought that was too much. I went across there one time unannounced, and there was bloody panic everywhere from the Admiral's staff down. That's another story. But ships needed working up to cater for Exocet type attacks and so on, which we gladly helped them with. But the fact they knew nothing about what the Sea Harrier could do for them was a shame, because it ended up with sometimes, you know, well, the Admiral's staff, they just didn't task properly. We could have won the war with less damage. If you put 800 Squadron in the weeds like us on Cap, west of San Carlos, we would have had three Cap stations filled for most daylight hours throughout the confrontation. Okay? As it was, they had 12 aircraft. We had eight aircraft, and they had more aircrew. So they had 50% more capability than us. So they had roughly two-thirds of the Cap responsibility. If they'd done the low-level Cap, we, with our one-third capability, turned away 450 missions. Think how many more missions would have been turned away. Like the.
Oh, that's all. That's interesting. Thank you. It's been amazing. You know, is there any, before we go finish, is there anything else that you think people should hear and listeners should know? Any lessons you'd like to pass on from your years of service and experience of bringing in an aircraft into service, which, from my own research, I know only two aircraft have been delivered on budget in the last 90-odd years of the Royal Navy. That was the Swordfish, which was pretty much a development of its predecessor and its predecessor's predecessor and its predecessor's predecessors, and the Sea Harrier FR-1. So, anything you'd like to pass on?
Yes, obviously I have very strong views about all this, and there are different viewpoints. And what one does have, what I haven't mentioned so far, in combat or in the war situation, you sometimes see things that you don't see them correctly. You think you're seeing something and you're not. I have researched everything I've been talking about. It has been researched by independent people from New Zealand in the Ministry of Defence about losses and how things happened and whatever. And the Americans tell me that, and they're still are very keen on the Falklands, that it was the last of the conventional, the old-fashioned wars, the Falklands War. But it's not the last time that Britain needs to have boots on the ground at sea. I like to use that term, because boots on the ground, the public understands it. It means you've got an army on land doing the business. And without it, you can't win land war. Without boots on the ground at sea, in other words, ships at sea, you can't win a maritime war. You can be supported either on land or at sea by land-based air sometimes, but not all the time. And for Britain to be able to impose its will on those who want to do us harm, we need to have the ability to strike them anywhere in the world. That is why the government, as stated by Philip Hammond, when he was Secretary of State for Defense, has chosen the carriers, our new carriers, as the central part of our strategic defense policy. What have we done with those two carriers? I won't go into it today, but basically what we've done is down-tuned them by going for the wrong, more expensive aircraft and putting a ramp on the deck, so they are no better than amphibious warfare carriers. And as such, could be very useful in support of American U.S. Marine Corps operations or something like that. But they cannot replace a fully-fledged strike carrier from America in the Gulf or elsewhere, because they don't have the air-to-air refueling, the airborne early warning, or the general capability of a fully fledged strike carrier with the right air group. So I would say to all listeners, yeah, take some of what I say with a pinch of salt, if you will, but do your research and you'll find out that I never say what I don't believe. And I believe what I've said today has been absolute truth as far as I'm concerned. Look at what Britain needs as a nation, as an island nation, with 90% of its trade coming by sea at least, and the difficulties around the world, and say, yeah, I believe we do need maritime power to be strong and to allow us to protect our interests, protect our trade, and allow our prosperity in the future. Without decent maritime power, and in particular strike carrier power, whether with manned or unmanned aircraft, we cannot do that. And we're at the moment going in slightly the wrong direction, but maybe we will change that with the first major refits of our new carriers and put on board cat and trap, catapult and arrestor gear, and a proper air group that gives the ship the capability it deserves and that our government wanted in the first instance. That's my main message.
And I did say earlier, I think you should plug your book. Come on. Where can our listeners find it?
And it's on sale on just about every email outlet, Sea Harrier Over the Falklands. Much applauded by my very good friend, Sandy Woodward, who sadly died last year. And I became very, very close to him. And he and I think the same. And he basically said, everything in Sharkey's book is right, except for the way he thinks I was thinking, because I wasn't. And of course, I confused him with his flag captain in my book, and I apologize. You'll see, if you get the book, read the foreword, and you'll see that I apologize sincerely for presuming to know what was going on in Sandy's head, when actually it was other people who were screwing up the war and giving me great frustration.
I will say, the fact that Sandy's gone is one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast series. I sat there and thought, there are so many people from the Second World War and those years who are not recorded, and we are losing the Falklands War as well. I wasn't going to let it happen. So that's why we're doing this with all these podcasts, and that's why we hope they help historians and people of the future who want to learn about the Falklands War, study them.
Well done, Alex. You're doing a great job.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for listening to this piece. I hope you found the podcast useful. I just wanted to add at the end my own thanks for all those who are helping me in putting this together. And should anyone wish to take part in this series, please do get in contact with either SimSec or the Phoenix Think Tank or British Naval History, or we'll point you in the direction of me, and I'll be glad, very, very glad, to take down your experiences of the Falklands War and publish them, because we need as many people as possible to take part in this series for it to be really effective. Thank you, and I hope this was useful.